Miami Memoirs presents real case histories and true stories related to the law practice and experiences of Florida attorney Lewis M. Ress. Miami Memoirs uncorks a caseload of true, weird, wonderful, and wild stories from an always eventful 6 decades of life in the law. From multi-million-dollar land deals to the ghostly aftermath of an Everglades plane disaster via a prematurely deep-frozen cat, these tales feature a parade of unforgettable characters, all sharply observed by a storyteller with a very human empathy for ordinary and extraordinary individuals caught up in the law.
Lewis has just released a new book, Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. Fans of strange cases and wild tales will need no introduction to the author's brilliant and fast-paced storytelling, laced with salty evocations of the human carnival of the era and shot through with compassionate insight. From advising the heir to Colonel Sanders and falling out with Buddy Hackett to nighttime jogging with Vitas Gerulaitis, the stories keep on coming. Larry the charismatic Wheeler dealer needs to be rescued from yet another risky deal, and a bridge-playing mobster needs help to find his missing daughter. All this and more, along with sage advice against buying a lottery ticket you might win. Welcome to round two. And now, let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Lewis Rez. I'm Jeanette Garcia, your host, and today we're on episode 45, Beat the Bank, the Second National Bank. Lewis, how are you doing today?
Oh, unbelievably great. Great,
good.
I'm always great.
Good,
at
good.
My age, just to be alive.
Yes. So this next story is Beat the Bank. Is that the same bank that Senator Holland helped you with?
Ah, you're so smart. Boy, are you sharp today. Yes, it is. It's exactly the same bank.
Great.
And the story starts at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
because it goes back to the charter.
Yes.
It's an old game. It goes back to the very first banks in America. When Willie Sutton, I don't know if you know who he was a famous bank robber.
Mm.
And he was asked, "Why do you rob banks?" And he answered, "Why, that's where the money is." So the banks were always targets. It became a challenge to defraud, to outwit, to loot and rob the bank. And it still is.
Mm.
It's like the casinos.
Right.
Where you go in to beat the casino.
Yeah, good luck.
And beat the bank.
Yeah, so the bank started off causing its own problem, right?
It did. You remember I told you that I got the charter for the bank through Senator Holland.
Right.
And we were very lucky to get that charter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Second National Bank of North Miami was formed in 1970 by my law partner, George Case, and his babysitter's son, Al Fasbus, who had just received his degree in economics from the University of Miami and who had no experience whatsoever in banking. The application provided that the bank would be located right near where we're sitting, on the corner of Biscayne Boulevard and Sanssouci Boulevard in North Miami.
What was the problem?
Well, the only problem was that the bank didn't own the property.
Oh.
Why they put that location into the charter application is beyond my understanding. But they did.
That's right.
Actually, Ed Worthington owned that corner, and it wasn't for sale.
Oh.
There was a single-story office building located on the property, and it had Ed Worthington's real estate office in there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a large vacant lot next door, just south of it. I was allowed to be a 10% investor in the bank because I got the charter through Washington, D.C. red tape. And having obtained the charter, I was rewarded with a 10% ownership. And there we were, stuck. I knew Ed Worthington. He was an older, tough-as-nails businessman. He was 60. He was slim. He was short. He had gray hair. And he had a grumpy attitude. His wife and his former secretary, Doreen, was 19.
What? That sounds more like a granddaughter or something. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they were a very unlikely couple. She was much taller than Ed. She was about 5'10" in her stocking feet. But she wore platform shoes. She wore dark-colored slacks, usually black or blue, with white shirt tops, all of which made her seem even more imposing. They had been married for about 1 year, and they just had a child.
Was that a trap?
Oh, man. You know, it's the Boca trap, we call it. You meet a rich guy, and you get married, and you have a child right away, and you never have to work again. That's the game. So the board of the bank was faced with an impossible task of buying the land from Ed Worthington, or trying to relocate the bank and to amend the bank charter, which was a very, very risky proposition. Mm-hmm. Once you get the charter, you don't want to come back to amend it. They're liable to take it from you.
Oh, yeah.
Sure enough, the secretary, Doreen, files for a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Worthington is outraged. There are claims for alimony, a division of the assets, child support, attorney's fees, and it goes on and on. Ed called me to ask that I represent him. He said, Doreen wants everything, 50-50, including my real estate business, the office building, the high-lift marina that I own, and where I keep my boat. And he had a 60-foot yacht there, and she also wants the yacht. It appears that it was a well-planned marriage on her part.
Oh, yeah. She went from secretary to pretty much running the show there, huh?
Yeah. That's how you do it. The power of women. So, the one thing Ed wants, besides being able to see his son, is to keep the marina and his boat. I explained to Ed that I am part of a group, the bank group, that wants to acquire the office building and the vacant lot. And he understands. He retains me, and he waives any potential conflict of interest.
Okay.
And I told him we were interested in acquiring that property. We needed it.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't hard to figure out that Doreen was only interested in hard cash. She was not interested in managing an office building or a marina. Anything that required any effort on her part, she was not interested. She knew that Ed wanted to live aboard the yacht.
And so did it work out?
Well, we were able to make a deal. She wanted cash. So Ed was able to buy Doreen out because I had the bank pay a substantial amount of cash for the office building and the additional lot.
Oh, yeah.
And the real estate business had no intrinsic value without Ed's personal work, and he intended to retire. So he was extremely happy to have his wife fully paid off and to save the marina and save his yacht. And we got a lot of child visitation because that wasn't a problem. Doreen wanted time for herself. She was glad to have him take the child. She was back on the prowl.
Mm-hmm. And sure was a problem solver for the bank.
It was. Finally, the Second National Bank was saved. We kept the existing office building that he had, the one-story building, and we built a separate bank building on the adjacent lot south of it, just facing Biscayne Boulevard.
Mm, okay.
Very then nice. The trouble started.
Oh.
More trouble.
More? Really?
Yeah, well, this was an ill-fated bank.
Wow.
The Second National Bank was now in temporary quarters, and every scam artist in the Southeast United States came in to try to match his or her wits against the bank, just like they do at the casino.
Mm-hmm.
So they lied on loan applications, and that was very frequent. It was more frequent than finding truthful applications. People tried to withdraw from their accounts without cleared funds being on deposit. Wives forged their husband's name. Men forged their wife's name. Forgers created bank checks, sometimes drawn on non-existent banks. They had them printed up. Fictitious businesses were created. And foreign money, bribe money, proceeds from illegal businesses, including gambling, prostitution, and drug dealing, were all to be cleansed through the bank's accounts. They came in with cash and bought bank checks, which then they deposited in other banks.
And did the locals try to take advantage of the bank, too?
Oh, are you kidding? The controller's office wanted us to participate in the community and make loans to community people.
Uh-huh.
So we had this guy, Martin's Meat Market, and I was on the board. I told him, don't lend him the money. You're going to get stung. He wanted to finance all his frozen meat display cases. And Martin's Meat Market opened in an Orthodox Jewish area. This means, and his meats were not kosher.
Mm-hmm.
So he only lasted a few months.
Yeah.
No one would buy his meat.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, including Martin, files bankruptcy to avoid paying back the bank. The bankruptcy courts don't like banks. But the worst and the most successful scam was perpetrated by our own government, the Internal Revenue Service.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to tell you about that later.
Yeah. So eventually the bank opened. How did the grand opening go?
Well, the grand opening. Robert Suedro, who has an office across the hall from where we're sitting, the brilliant architect known for creating the direct entry private residential elevator and the brains behind the design of the famous Aquilina condo hotel on Miami Beach, he created the Second National Bank building. It was stunning, built on a low platform, all glass, modern, with clean lines and large entrances from both Biscayne Boulevard side and from the back parking lot. The grand opening was advertised in the local newspapers. Invitations were mailed to a list of potential depositors and customers drawn from the names submitted by the 10-member board of directors. Banners were put up all around the bank. There were sandwiches, cookies, cakes, beverages, keychains with the bank medallion on them, free coffee mugs with the bank's logo on them, all set up for the opening ceremony, which was scheduled for 5 p.m. on a beautiful Tuesday evening.
Oh, boy. I'm anxious to hear how that went.
Well, here we go. At exactly 4:59 p.m., a large black bus stopped at the rear entrance to the bank. 30 senior citizens quickly entered the bank from the parking lot with plastic shopping bags and thermos bottles. They were dressed in shorts, T-shirts, and wore thong flip-flops. They descended on the bank like locusts. It was Retirement Village, and the sign on the bus said so. Retirement Village, living in paradise.
And what were they up to?
Well, they quickly emptied the coffee urns into their thermos bottles. They swept the sandwiches and cookies into plastic bags. They grabbed up all the keychains and coffee mugs and stuck them in the plastic bags.
Wow. What a grand opening, huh?
Yeah. Within 5 minutes after their arrival, they were back in their bus and gone. The officers of the bank, all in dark suits, white shirts and ties, stood there in utter amazement. The boll weevils had struck. Guests were arriving to a disaster area, and there was a mad scramble to run to the nearest restaurants and stores to replace the food. Clerks worked to clean and replace the coffee cups, which were brought up from a storeroom in boxes. The bank never got not even one account from with a Retirement Village address.
No surprise there. What next? Everybody seems out to damage the bank.
Well, this is the wild one. Oh. The IRS, United States Internal Revenue Service, scammed the bank.
Oh, my gosh.
Can you imagine the government perpetrating a fraud? Well,
jeez,
they did. It's a true story. And you can check it out. The case against the Second National Bank, the federal case, is in the records. The appellate decision is in all the federal records. So you can get on your Google and Google United States Internal Revenue Service versus the Second National Bank and find it. And you can read the appellate decision. And I'm quoting accurately. What happened was Buildit Corporation, that's a good name for a contracting company.
Buildit.
Buildit Corporation was constructing a huge shopping mall at the Marathon Shopping Center, which was going to be located in the western part of Miami near the center of the county. So it was out near Flagler Street. Delight Electric. That's a hell of a good name for an electric company.
Yeah.
Delight. You turn on Delight.
Delight.
It's a delight to turn on the light. Delight Electric was the electrical subcontractor. And those are the ones that did all the wiring and electrical work and all the fixtures, lighting fixtures and so on.
Yeah.
They had over 190 electrical workers working on the job.
Wow.
And they were all unionized. And their union representative, after some of Delight's payroll checks were returned for insufficient funds, he exercised the right under the union employment contract to demand separate payment to each 190 electrical worker by bank check or money order. And so they had to cut, when they made payroll, they had to have 190 bank checks to pay these employees.
Yeah.
Buildit, the general contractor, would pay for the electrical work done by Delight, the electrical contractor, by having Buildit's bank, Midpoint Trust, issue a check to Delight's bank. And Delight's bank was the Second National Bank, which would be used to cover the electrical workers' weekly payroll checks.
Right.
the Second National Bank would issue the 190 bank checks in various amounts, each representing an individual worker's weekly wage. The general contractor, Builded, would deposit the payroll payment from its bank midpoint into the Second National Bank, which was Delight's bank, on a Friday afternoon. And there wasn't time for Midpoint's check to clear into Second National Bank's funds. So a friend of Delight Electric, who also had accounts at Second National, guaranteed Midpoint's trust check.
Hmm.
Okay, there was no problem. There was money in there. It was enough to cover it.
Right.
And it was about 5 in the evening when the Second National Bank finished. All the clerks had to cut these 190 individual payroll checks. And the representative of the electrical contractor, Delight, told the clerk at the Second National Bank not to bother putting in each worker's name.
Mm-hmm.
That Delight would do that clerical task and save time since the Second National was about to close for the weekend. All went well. Midpoint's trust check cleared into Second National Bank's account. Delight filled in the names of each employee and paid each electrical worker. The union was satisfied.
Okay, but so how did the IRS scam start then?
Well, the next week, it starts with a visit to the electrical contractor, Delight, by two IRS agents. They met in the conference room with Delight's president and corporate attorney. The senior IRS agent was a man of about 50, dark-haired, with a large mustache, dressed in a baggy gray suit with green tie. The IRS agent pointed his index finger at the face of Delight's president and waved it at him and spoke first. He said, "You know, you owe the government $100,000 in past withholding taxes, and you faced criminal charges. You had better cooperate with us."
Oh, gosh.
Well, the guy was shaking in his pants.
Yeah. It's IRS?
It would be speculation to know the exact words used in that conversation, but it is quoted in the criminal trial, in the lawsuit, where the government sued to collect the money from the bank, the judge mentions that conversation, and it did in fact happen. The ultimate result was the hatching of a plot, where IRS is going to get its hands on the electrical contractor's workers' payroll, and to apply that payroll against the electrical contractor's overdue taxes.
Mm.
So IRS prepared a rubber stamp, which said paid to the United States Internal Revenue Service, and which just fit over the place where the worker's name would appear on the bank checks from Second National Bank, with the intent by IRS to divert the electrical workers' payroll funds to the government.
Oh, wow.
The very same IRS agents sat in the electrical contractor's office on the next Friday afternoon.
Wow, okay.
That Friday, the same payroll scenario was repeated. The general contractor billed it. In order to make the weekly payment for the electrical subcontractor's employees, transferred $83,000 from its account at Midpoint Trust to Delight's account at the Second National Bank. The Midpoint check was exactly the same type as had been deposited the week earlier.
Mm-hmm.
However, this time, the friend of Delight's who had guaranteed Midpoint's check was not called on to guarantee the funds.
Mm-hmm.
The bank's clerks were asked to make the electrical contractor's workers' payroll again. In the meantime, the president of the Second National Bank, Al Fassbus, said that he ordered the bank not to make the payroll. But this seems very much to be in doubt because the clerks, pressed by the electrical contractor, issued 190 blank checks in different amounts with blank names to be filled in by the electrical contractors individually with each worker's name to be put in. It was after 6 in the evening when the electrical contractor's representatives left with those 190 blank bank checks. They took them back to Delight's office ostensibly to put in each employee's name on his or her check.
Mm-hmm.
The IRS agents were waiting right there in Delight's office, in the electrical contractor's office. They took the payroll checks and used their rubber stamp to insert the government's name on each one of the 190 electrical workers' payrolls.
Wow.
They immediately deposited all of those funds into the IRS Treasury Department's account. account.
My goodness.
Well, the union representative had been waiting for the workers' payroll in a separate room.
Oh, no.
When the checks were not produced, he called Midpoint Trust and told them that the payroll was stolen and to stop payment. And they stopped payment on the Midpoint check to Second National, which they did. Second National learned that Midpoint had stopped its check, and Second National stopped payment on all of the 190 bank checks which had been deposited by IRS. I remember being called. I was in my office when this was going on. Mm-hmm. And they said, what do we do? I said, stop payment on those checks.
Yeah.
They're stolen. It's been stolen. Midpoint Trust used the $83,000 it had left on deposit with the contractor's account to pay the electrical workers, and it had to pay the union a penalty of $10,000 in addition.
Wow. What happened next?
Well, Midpoint, the bank, sued the contractor's bank, sued Second National, the electrical contractor's bank, for the $10,000 penalty that they had to pay under the union contract. And IRS, Second National had stopped all those checks to IRS. IRS sued Second National in federal court to compel the bank to make good on the 190 checks.
Wow.
Well, Shelley Rosenberg, my partner, handled the litigation for the bank, and I supervised it. And the federal trial judge found that the Second National Bank was responsible. And I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
We took an appeal. The Federal Court of Appeals said, quote, the hapless bank was left holding the bag for someone else's tax liability, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
They made the Second National Bank make good on all of those bank checks, the 190 bank checks, plus interest and costs to IRS.
Ugh.
And they said, too bad.
That's unbelievable. The court actually allowed the IRS to scam the bank.
Well, where I come from, when we played stickball on the streets, there was a rule. You can't make a bad ball good. Those checks were obtained by fraud. They were tainted. They were bad.
Mm.
IRS didn't pay a thing for them. They were used, or supposed to be used, to pay the electrical workers. But IRS grabbed them and converted them and used them to pay the employer Delight's taxes. The appellate court said that IRS was a relentless tax collector, unquote, and that the electrical contractor was, quote, a resourceful taxpayer, unquote. That's nonsense.
Yeah. What do you think, Lewis?
Well, I think IRS and Delight were thieving connivers, each guilty of conspiring to defraud the workers and the Second National Bank. The IRS and the electrical contractor, Delight, colluded to take money from an innocent party and use it to pay the obligation of one of the conspirators to the unearned benefit of the other co-conspirator.
Mm-hmm. And what did you conclude?
It's amazing how lawyers and judges can convolute facts, twist ethics, ignore common decency and common sense, and distort legal theory to arrive at bizarre decisions.
Mm.
Can you imagine? This is an appellate court condoning a fraud by the government.
Yeah, pretty much. You summed it up. And then, so what else happened? I'm sure the history of this Second National Bank is not over. What came next?
There's always more. The Second National Bank got it good. The next one is called the Big Robbery. It was a Friday night, and the Second National Bank was closed until Monday. My cousins were coming to visit from New York City, and we had just finished dinner in North Miami. Right here on Biscayne Boulevard, there was a restaurant called Gallagher's, where the filet mignon steak dinner cost $3.50 and included a large baked potato, which was called a tubby. And there was an assortment of stuffings like sour cream, chopped scallions, bacon chips, and it included a dessert. There were six of us, along with our five-year-old son, Andrew, and having dinner. And my office building was just adjacent to the new bank. My cousins had admired my large personal office. I was showing them around with the matched rosewood paneling and a long white marble desk. It was an ego trip.
It sounds like an ego trip. But you came a long way from Brooklyn, so
yeah,
you deserve to shine it off.
Yeah, after all, I did. Yes, I did come a long way.
Yes.
And now for the final impression, a tour of the bank. So the six of us walked across the parking lot, and I had the key, and I opened the outer door, and I turned off the alarm system. I knew how to do that. And I showed off the brand new bank. My cousin said, "Oh, wow, Lewis, you are an owner and director and attorney for the bank. Wow, have you come a long way." Mm-hmm. And I took them behind the scenes, and we wound up in the vault room. I had a pass key that opened the stainless steel gate, and we stood in front of the floor-to-ceiling Masla steel safe door. It was mounted on two huge hinges, and they were secured to the steel door frame by interlocking bolts. And the interlocking bolts were over 3 feet high.
Wow.
There were two ship's wheel spoked handles controlling the inner bolts to the door. You would spin these big wheels, and the bolts would slide. Each of the bolts was 6 inches in diameter, huge. And they would slide out from the door and interlock with the huge door frame. Every part of the door was shining. I said, "Oh, we are so proud of this part of the bank. It's completely secure. This door cannot be breached." So one of my cousins said, "What about going through the wall next to the door?" And I said, "That's a very good question. The walls are reinforced concrete over 2 feet thick. The concrete is interlaced with steel rods, which crisscross every 6 inches. These walls are impenetrable. Our vault boxes and cash are so secure that we don't even have a separate ADT burglar alarm system in here."
Well, it does sound pretty safe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, what's coming. Something's going to happen.
Yeah. In the meantime, our son Andrew, who is now a plastic surgeon in Boca Raton and who operated on my leg yesterday,
wow.
He was known as the Tornado. He was running around the bank, putting his hands and palm prints on everything, especially that shiny steel vault door.
Yeah. So what happened next?
Well, it was about 6 a.m. the next morning when the burglars entered the bank.
Yeah.
They wore plastic gloves. They quickly dismantled the outside alarm system and went right to the vault room. They attached a long garden hose to a spigot outside the bank, in the back of the bank, and they used a cylindrical diamond-tipped water-cooled drill and started to drill out cylinders of the reinforced concrete from the wall right next to the vault door. And it was a slow process.
Were they successful?
Yeah. Frank Browder, the new bank president, had decided to do some work that day at the bank. It was a Saturday morning. And he showed up at about 8, and he was immediately bound, gagged, blindfolded, and thrown into the corner of the outer vault room.
Oh, wow.
The burglars were concerned that other employees might arrive, and they redoubled their efforts to drill out all 6 tubular holes, and then using a large sledgehammer, knocked out the concrete core that was left in the circle of holes, making enough room for them to go through the opening and gain access to the vault boxes.
Wow.
They immediately went to the bank's large cash box and drilled out the lock. There was over $93,000 in cash in there. They put the cash into a large plastic bag, and there was no time left to drill each of the individual boxes, vault boxes.
And what did they do next?
Well, they were worried that somebody would come in.
Yeah.
And because they knew that the president was in there.
Mm-hmm.
So they left. And within an hour, Frank Browder was discovered. And the police, and particularly the FBI, were called, and they were at the scene. And I was called, and I got there fast enough to see a large pool of water and the 6 concrete cylinders which had been cut out of the wall. Fortunately, we were insured for our cash box, the $93,000. Thank the Lord.
What did the insurance company do?
Well, the insurance company was the Aetna Casualty Insurance Company, and they had a 24-hour telephone line, and they were very calm, and they suggested that they would issue us a check for the $93,000, and then we could sit down and go over an accurate number. We would adjust any balance, and if we owed them, we'd pay them, and if they owed owed us, they paid us more. Of course, I just happened to be their attorney, too.
Yeah.
And by Saturday evening, the Aetna had delivered a check for $93,000. They trusted us.
Well, that's good, yeah. And what happened after that?
Well, on Sunday, two things happened. The Aetna check had been enlarged and mounted on a large cardboard, and the media were all over us. And rather than deal with the reporters individually, we called a press conference. And I held up the check, and I thanked the Aetna again. And it made local television and the Miami newspapers. Then I called the FBI.
What did you say to the FBI?
I said, I know you're looking for a midget. In those days, we used that ill-advised description of little people. I said, those palm prints that you're looking at belong to my 5-year-old son, Andrew the Tornado. He still doesn't like me to call him the Tornado. But he is. He's still a tornado.
And, I guess, does he like when you tell the story?
No.
Not at all.
No.
Okay.
He doesn't like to hear that story. And I had the bank make up one of the concrete cylinders with the ends of the reinforcing steel rods showing and mount it on a large marble base. And we made it into a trophy with a bronze plaque in appreciation of the Aetna's fast action and trust. And the Aetna wasn't too pleased. I brought it down there to the claims office and they stuck it in a closet and kept it there.
And then after that, what happened?
Well, at the next board meeting, I reminded the directors of their personal liability. Had the individual vault boxes been drilled, we didn't have insurance. And they unanimously agreed to install a full alarm system, which we did right away.
Oh, great. That's good. And then, whatever happened to the robbers?
Well, I don't like statute of limitations, so I don't believe in them. I don't believe in bankruptcy. The robbers were ultimately found in Key West.
Oh.
Well after the time within which they could be charged because of the statute of limitations barring prosecution for the crime.
Oh, and so how'd that end up? What happened to the bank?
Well, the burglars beat the bank. The retirement villagers beat the bank. The IRS beat the bank.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, beat on all fronts.
And, yeah, and we sold the Second National Bank to another bank, and the purchasing bank resold it to a third bank, and the third owner sold it to an even larger bank who used it for a branch but later abandoned it. Then the structure was bulldozed only a few years ago. And today, right now as we're sitting here, the Second National Bank, located on Biscayne Boulevard on the south side of Sanssouci Boulevard in North Miami, is a vacant lot.
Wow, completely gone.
Totally beaten. Totally gone forever. I don't know. I'm sure they're going to build something there.
Yeah.
But it's a vacant lot.
Wow, what a story. A lot to digest here and go through. So what are some lessons that we can learn from this?
Well, what you learn is the Boy Scout motto. You know what the Boy Scout motto is?
No, I don't.
Be prepared. Be prepared.
Yes.
So what you learn is, I figured it out, but what you learn is you must have contingency planning. Especially if you're a corporation in business in the United States today. But the bank should have planned what it was going to do. It was the bank's fault. The bank was negligent. First of all, the bank should have never paid IRS unless the checks that made that payroll, unless the checks were cleared funds. And they didn't. They wrote a check on uncleared funds. Number two, you always have an alarm system in the vault. And nowadays, you have cameras and you have motion alarms and
layers.
All kinds of alarms.
Yeah.
And it's easy to have, and you must.
Yeah.
You can't chinch. You can't be tight with the money. We were
They're
a bank.
Lose
we
it
were
all.
Trying to make money. And we should have tied up the land before we filed for the charter.
Definitely.
That's not hard. You get an option. You don't put the bank, you get an option on the vacant property, or you pick a piece of property where you can get an option
right.
if Ed Worthington wouldn't give you an option. So that was a mistake. Mm-hmm. They didn't prepare. And they should have screened the people who they were inviting to the grand opening, and they should have had security at the door. And you are forewarned about the people from Century Village. You pardon me, tell you where they were. They were Century Village people, and they come and loot banks. That's what they do. So we should have planned ahead. Life is, to a great extent, like a chess game. And you have to keep thinking, you have to have a plan and keep thinking, what if, what if? You cannot just react. It's often too late. You want me to give you examples of that?
Yes, please.
I mean, cyber war with Putin. It's coming.
Yeah.
No one has talked about cyber war this whole time with Ukraine that's been going on now for almost a month.
Yeah.
In fact, more than a month.
Well,
if you think
years.
all the time that he worked up to it.
Yeah.
We had good intelligence. We knew he was going to do it, invade. No one has thought of cyber war. The president hasn't mentioned it. He hasn't said as a sanction, we're going to use cyber war to jam up your economy, and he's afraid that if we do, they'll do that right back and jam up us. Mm-hmm. And they're stealing right and left from our country, the fraud people. Mm-hmm. They closed down an electrical grid. They closed down a company that has petroleum, and they demand ransom. Mm-hmm. So you have ransomware. Mm-hmm. Every corporation should consider that. They should have a program to save their, to close off their present network of computers and have alternate two or three backups.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do that. What if? What if? The bank should never have paid funds. They should never open doors to strangers. You should never cut corners. Never do away with an alarm system. And if you're going to have an affair with your secretary, I have a rule. Don't have sex with people in your office. Mm. That was my rule in the office. You're just begging for trouble. It's trouble from the word the get-go. And sometimes there are marriages that happen where you say, how can people who are in love with one another and who find one another so attractive not go out on a date together and have a relationship? Well, they should get different jobs.
Yeah.
One of them move out. Because
there's
you
options.
Ought to think twice before you have an affair with your secretary. It's going to happen. You're going to get stung.
Mm-hmm.
And you should make checklists. So those are some of the things. I was thinking of some of the places where Putin has behaved, where he's in this chess game and we're not reacting properly. What other countries have been invaded with what consequences? So I went back to look where invasions have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, recently China took over Tibet.
Mm.
What happened? You ever hear of anything in the UN? You ever see anything about China? We're going to invade China because of Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
Let's GoFundMe Tibet. We'll send them $1 billion. We're nothing.
Yes.
The Tibet people are, Tibetanese, I guess, are sitting there tattooed. And what about the other group that they took to concentration or reorientation? And then you have Kashmir. Who's talking about Kashmir? Well, the Pakistanis and the Indians are fighting like crazy. They're actually shooting at one another over that land.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, so these are other examples of land grabs.
Mm-hmm.
Not involving Putin, but one of them does. Syria, Putin's involved with Assad.
Mm.
And they took over property. Morocco. Well, Morocco, there's Western Sahara. Are you familiar with the issue of Western Sahara,
mm-hmm.
Morocco?
No.
Just south of Morocco, Morocco's on the ocean,
mm-hmm.
just south of it, at the end of the Sahara Desert ends there, there is the Western Sahara, and they're claiming that.
Oh.
And you can't go down there. Sudan has problems with Egypt. Mm-hmm. And Ethiopia and Eritrea have problems with tiger revolutions or terrorists. Mm. They're all fighting one another. In China, they're having trouble with the China and Japan are having fights over the islands in the East China Sea. Mm. They're building these islands. China has taken over, and they're a threat to Japan. And look at Israel and the Palestinians.
Oh, yeah.
Fighting over. I mean, they don't stop.
It's
and
been
each
ongoing
one says, I was here first. That was the big argument. I was here first.
Right.
Well, if you go back, actually, in Israel, I think Jordan was there first. And before that, it was all kinds of things going all the way back to the Crusaders and before. Mm-hmm. So that's what's going on. And what about Moldova? Well, and Georgia? Well, Putin, this is nothing new. Putin gets involved in all, he's gotten involved in all of the countries who were in the USSR, where it ended, when it ended. And there's a whole bunch of them. I don't know how many, I counted how many I could think of. It's about 15. I could list them. Including Georgia and Belarus. Belarus was taken over. Now it's part of Russia, pretty much. They're pretty much absorbed by Russia. And there's Ukraine is a big issue now.
Yeah.
And Georgia and Armenia and Uzbekistan and a couple of them, Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and Azerbaijan and Moldova. And Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan, and Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. So you have a whole bunch of countries,
goes on.
And they, a lot of them border on one another, and they have Russian roots. And if you go back to the history, he says it's my land. You know, I'm coming in to take my land back.
Yeah.
Well. Another example of land grabs, talking about land grabs. There was a land grab by Italy in 1935, as I recall. I was 5 years old. Italy invaded Ethiopia.
Hmm.
And they had a big airplane. They had an air force, and they came in and took over Ethiopia.
Wow.
And there was Haile Selassie was the emperor, and he really came up from the ranks. He married the princess or something.
Huh.
He married the father-in-law, the daughter of the owner, and became head of the government, Haile Selassie. And he went to the League of Nations and said, this is terrible, and they're invading me, and help me. And the League of Nations didn't, I don't think they did, and maybe they did some sanctions which were totally ineffective.
Mm.
They find in general sanctions are ineffective.
Yeah.
So what happened then was in 1941, I think it was, England had enough of it. And it was bothering their strategy in their African strategy. They were involved in the Sudan and in Egypt and in Palestine. And it was annoying them. Haile Selassie was an embarrassment. And they went in and freed up. They invaded. Mm. And they freed Ethiopia.
Mm.
And Haile Selassie died from questionable circumstances.
Huh.
Actually, he was assassinated, and he was choked to death.
Huh. Okay.
But few people know that.
Huh.
So if you ask someone on the street, hey, how did Haile Selassie die? Who?
Yeah, most people don't
even
know
who
it is.
He made an impassioned speech at the League of Nations.
Hmm.
And it tells you about how far you go with impassioned speeches. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's going on with preparing in advance and how the bank robbers, by the way, the IRS got away with it. Mm-hmm. The bank robbers got away with it. Mrs. Worthington got away with it.
Uh-huh.
The condo commandos got away with it. So it doesn't, I don't like statute of limitations. When you find the guy that robbed the bank, they want to be prosecuted no matter how long it is. Why are they getting the benefit of years? What good does it do society? I don't think it does any. And I don't like bankruptcies where you can indifferent to your obligations and then discharge them without making a payment plan. I like a plan where you pay for the rest of your life, but you pay off your debts. You can have no interest, you can have partial payments and long-term payments, but your debt gets paid.
Yeah, it creates accountability.
Right. I think that's very important.
Yes.
So, what else? We were talking about what's going on now?
Mm-hmm.
Be prepared. So when else can we be prepared? The Putin is now talking about using chemical warfare. Just two days ago, and Biden is responding, we'll be in trouble, you'll be sorry. He doesn't say what we'll do. Tell him what we'll do.
Yes.
And maybe he should say what we'll do.
Right.
And it's no big secret. I'm sure they listen in on our conversations, and they know more than the American public. But do you know anything about the gas?
It's terrible.
I know a lot about
it.
Because I was in the Ordnance Corps. And there's an arsenal right up near Aberdeen Proving Grounds. Aberdeen Proving Grounds is the largest military installation probably in the world, 100 miles square.
Wow.
And at the end of it is an arsenal where in World War I where they started making poison gas.
Oh, jeez.
And the history of poison gas in the United States is amazing. The chemical corps.
Mm.
The chemical corps was formed because of the poison gas used in World War I. So you have mustard gas, you have phosgene, which is being manufactured. We were using it in shells, in proximity shells, where the shell would be shot and there would be a fuse that would be radar controlled, sound controlled, and the shell would go off in the midair and not hit the ground.
Wow.
And when it came close to the ground, it would go off. And then the gas would come out. And
do gas masks protect against that at all? Or?
Well, gas masks are truly a very questionable thing there. The first gas mask leaked like crazy. And then when they leaked, you had this desire to rip it off. You couldn't keep it on. You was inhaling fumes. So they ripped it off and people died from ripping it off. So a lot of deaths from...
Wow.
A lot of people were gassed in World War One. Then the gas masks, they're made out of charcoal and cotton.
Mm.
That's how they filter it. That's the canister.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it does a really fine job. There's much better way, I'm sure, today with chemical engineering than charcoal. And they used to shoot it in the air like artillery shells, and they would shoot canisters.
Yeah.
And it was terrible. Many, many people on both sides were damaged. More people were wounded and didn't die, so they had to be hospitalized. It's economically, from a military point of view, it's better to wound somebody seriously. They don't come back on active duty, and you have to keep them in the hospital. You got 10 people to look after them,
mm-hmm.
between the medical people and the hospitals, and the cost to pay them their salaries.
Yeah.
So it's better to maim them than it is to kill them.
Yeah.
Well, they had napalm in World War II,
mm-hmm.
and Agent Orange. No one talks about Agent Orange. And they had firebombs. There's a lot of stuff. What will we do? I don't know. You're going to use an atomic bomb? We used it in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Was that the most deaths in any attack? Do you know?
Was it?
No.
No.
Which was the most deaths from any attack? I can tell you.
I don't know.
We firebombed Tokyo in 1945.
Oh, wow.
And there were 160,000 civilians died. There were 10 full acres, or maybe more, burned in Tokyo. I mean, it was terrible. That was March 9th, 1945. That was the worst. Cologne, In Cologne, Germany, we sent in 1,000 planes. 1,000 planes. You talk about bombing civilians. Oh, by the way, in Japan, those were all civilians that
yes.
we killed.
Yes.
And we had special bombs made to handle the type of construction in Tokyo. These bombs were designed to have the worst effect. They would split into 10 bombs, all incendiaries. And they were designed to burn down the city. So now we're complaining about the Russians doing that to the Ukrainians. We did it to the Japanese.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they had, in Cologne, they used 1,000 planes in a single night. It was May 30th, 1942, when they destroyed Cologne. Wow. How many people died, I don't know. Dresden, we sent over 1,300 planes on February 13th, 1945. And there was no real military reason. They made these nice porcelain dolls, the Dresden dolls.
Uh-huh.
And they said about 50,000 military industrial workers were there, but I don't think so. We said that 25,000 people were killed. They bombed it for 3 nights in a row.
Wow.
The Germans claimed that over 100,000 were killed.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody knows to this day.
Yeah.
So it gives you an idea of some of the stuff has been done before. They used gas in the war between Iraq and Iran.
Hmm.
They're not, Iraq and Iran are not parties to the Geneva Convention.
Right.
Where we made gas warfare illegal.
Mm-hmm.
But Putin doesn't seem to be concerned about the Geneva Convention.
Nope.
And we're going to have to respond. And we've got a lot of stuff. And there's all kinds of noxious gases that... that knock out crops and kill cattle and not only people.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's used on civilians, they kill civilians. It's terrible. So I was looking and saying, how can, what's the history of Ukraine? Do you know?
I mean, I know Russia had it during Soviet Union.
Well, yeah, but
that's pretty much recent. That's recent. Yeah.
So nobody knows. You ask the average person on the street, PhD. You go to the schools and get a PhD in history and say, what's the history of Ukraine? They don't know. Actually, Ukraine belonged, was part of Poland.
Oh, okay.
And it goes back before World War II. And... In 1686, there was a treaty of perpetual peace between Poland and Russia, and they took Ukraine and partitioned it.
Mm.
And all of Ukraine, east of the Dnieper River, the major river that runs through it, I've been on it, east of that was Russian, and west of it was Polish.
Mm.
And so the history of Ukraine is not one country all by itself forever, like the United States, and we took it from the Indians. That's not the case at all.
Right, yeah.
They had a war with the Soviets, 1917 to 1921. Then in 1922, it became the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. Then Khrushchev was the head of the Ukrainian Communist Party. And 1945, Ukrainian SSR became a country. And the Russians tried to, they use Russification, the language, culture, people. They infuse people into a country. And they've been doing that for years and years and years in all the USSR countries, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. They've been bringing in Russian immigrants and Russian culture. The French did that a lot, too. They had the Alliance Française, which is the French culture. They supplemented that in all these in all other countries,
The colonies,
right. So that's some of it. Then you look at Belarus. Well, Belarus was known as White Russia, and that was where the Fiddler on the Roof was in Belarus and Minsk and Pinsk, and that was called the Pale. That was where all the Jewish people lived. They lived in. Belarus and Poland, and they were all exterminated. Hungary, everyone, and in Ukraine, and they're all gone.
Wow.
They're all gone. Jews used to make up over one half of the urban population of Belarus. and they're gone.
Wow.
They were big, I think, at least over 10% of the Polish population. They're gone. They were killed. There's nothing left. And Belarus was affected by Chernobyl. Did you know what happened with the pollution from the... well, it went north.
Traveled north. Oh,
it went north and went to Canada. And when it's on the border, if you look at Chernobyl, it's on the border of Belarus.
Oh, geez.
And so the toxic fumes went into Belarus. And one-fifth, 20% of the land in Belarus is radioactively contaminated now.
Wow.
You didn't know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, so this stuff that we're going through is nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing new. The Russians have been infiltrating these countries and trying to take them over physically for a long time. So I think I've told you a good bit about be prepared. So my concern is, where is the plan, the conclusion?
Yeah.
Where is the plan? What if? Did we have a thing? What if Putin does this? What if they use an atomic bomb?
Yeah, are we ready?
What are we waiting for? This government should learn from the Boy Scouts. And we should have contingency plans and tell them. Inflation. There's a way to handle inflation. Inflation on the supply side economics comes from the abundance or the absence of a product and the need for it. So if you want something, you pay for it and it gets inflated. The price goes up. If there's a glut, the price goes down. So if you're producing, let's say, grain, if you're producing or milk, if you're producing so much that there's no market for it and people stop using it, the price drops. And if you're producing a little of it and there's a need for it, the price goes up. So that's what oil is like. And we should have a plan. We should have had a much better plan for the gasoline shortage. We should have immediately affected it. Take the 18-cent tax on the gasoline and do away with it. And make sure that the seller of the gasoline transfers that savings to the buyer and doesn't pocket it. Because they're greedy.
Yeah.
And there should be an excess profit tax on gasoline, and there should be a control of the price of gasoline. And you can do it if you control the source and the fracking, and you can supplement the income to people that are starting back up, starting to produce it in Oklahoma. There's plenty of oil still in the ground in Oklahoma and in Texas and in a lot of the country. Then you have gasoline, oil coming from Canada. You have a contingency plan to get it from Canada, from countries like even Venezuela, if you have to. You have a deal with OPEC that once the price of gasoline reaches such and such a barrel, that they supply more to bring the price down. And it's simple to have a treaty with them. We do them enough favors. So we should tell them, you got all our wonderful jets. We're not going to supply ammunition for the jets. Unless no more bombs for them, unless you sell us oil at a reasonable price. I don't see these things happening in the government, and it concerns me. So it's just like the bank. Be prepared. The government should be prepared.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well,
that's what I have to say.
Very insightful. Thank you, Lewis. Learned quite a lot, as always.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs, and be sure to pick up a copy of Lewis Rest's new book on Amazon.